From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Reginald Hardwick, Illinois Public Media News and Public Affairs Director. Dialogue is an exchange about culture straight from the soul. After 30 years in office, Dick Durbin will soon retire from the U.S. Senate. That has touched off a spirited race between Democratic and Republican candidates. In our last segment, we heard from Democrats Robin Kelly and Juliana Stratton. A third Democrat, Congressman Raja Krishnamurti, has agreed to an interview but hasn't been able to schedule one yet. Now let's turn to the Republican Party. Don Tracy talked with Brian Mackey of The 21st Show in early November.
Tracy was born in Mount Sterling, a small town in rural western Illinois. He's the oldest of 12 children. He attended Western Illinois University, earned a bachelor's degree in business administration from Arizona State, and got his law degree from the University of Memphis. He's been an attorney for more than five decades now, currently senior counsel at Brown, Hay & Stevens, a firm that boasts a young Abraham Lincoln among its former members. Tracy previously ran for lieutenant governor in 2010, and he served as head of the state's gaming board under Governor Bruce Rauner.
I'm glad to be here, but I have to point out I was born in Urbana.
Oh, good to know.
Where we are right now, not Mount Sterling. I grew up in Mount Sterling, but I was born in Urbana. My parents both graduated from the University of Illinois.
All right. I have a number of policy questions I want to get to, because obviously one of the big aspects of being a senator is dealing with policy, particularly foreign policy. Let's start there. It's been 2 years since Hamas attacked Israel, and Israel has been waging war in Gaza. How do you assess the United States' response to October 7th and all that's happened since?
I think it's been measured and appropriate from the very beginning. We don't have boots on the ground there, but Israel has been a very strong ally of ours for many years in the Mideast and continues to be, and we should support our allies. The United States needs, and I particularly appreciate our efforts to bring peace finally in the Mideast. That is a really hard climb, but it needs to be done. I'd like to say, when people ask me why I'm so interested in politics, even though I haven't made I'm not a career politician, it's not been my career. The jobs I've done in politics don't pay, except gaming board paid $500 a meeting, but it was not quite a full-time job. It was about a half-time job as chair. But as I like to say, politics, I think, are one of the most important human endeavors, because with good politics, you have peace and prosperity. And with bad politics, you have war, death, and destruction. I think it's the most important human good. Politics is the most important human endeavor, the most complex also, aside from war. And politics is the alternative to war.
I agree with that sentiment. You know, I want to stick with this situation in Israel and Gaza, though, because some have called what Israel did there a genocide, right? 64,000 Palestinians, according to the Associated Press, have been killed. What do you think of that characterization?
I think it's absolutely wrong. By the way, do you know how many people died in World War II?
Millions, right? Tens of millions.
Right. The latest estimate I saw was 60 to 90 million. I'd been saying 50 million for years, but I guess that revision, that has been revised upward now. War is awful, and there's always collateral damage in war. And I have heard from others who have studied this far more than me is that Israel, and defending itself and responding to the October 7th Hamas attack, brutal attack, has done a better job of minimizing collateral damage than almost any other warring nation in a war of this consequence. I know people may disagree with that because, today wars are more televised, there's more information, so we're more aware of the collateral damage to war. But if you want to look to a war where there's a lot of collateral damage, look at World War II.
Okay. One of the other constitutional roles of a United States senator is to advise and confirm the president's nominations for cabinet secretaries and many other positions, judges. What do you think of President Trump's cabinet selections so far?
I wasn't a fan of Matt Gaetz nomination.
The one who didn't make it through.
All right.
For Attorney General.
I'm particularly pleased with Scott Bessent, Howard Lutnick, Brooke Collins, Marco Rubio. I think, you know, the jury's still out on Secretary of War Hegseth, but I generally like what he's doing.
In what way? Say more about that.
I'm focusing on the military as being a lethal fighting force, as being capable of defending the country and waging war. War is a terrible, dirty business, but you need people that are trained to do that, trained to kill people, basically. And it just seemed to me that under Biden, there were distractions in the military based on social issues that, that
Black History Month, that sort of thing.
That took away from the mission. I don't know all the distractions, but Hegseth seems laser focused on training soldiers to kill. And it's a harsh thing to say, but that is the job of a soldier.
What about Health and Human Services Secretary RFK Jr., who was not a Republican until it seems that he joined the administration?
My son is a probably shouldn't bring my family in this, but he's a independent and he's been selling RFK to me for some time now. He homeschools his children, I was surprised, at that. But I like a lot of people, lost a lot of faith in the medical community during the COVID crisis, I think, and a lot of political leaders. I think they delegated way too much power to the medical community. And I think there were representations made by the national medical community that certain things about medicine were settled when they really weren't, and they quashed dissenting opinions. As a lawyer, I believe in majority and dissenting opinions, and I don't think I don't think dissenting opinions should be quashed. So I think the medical community, based on the COVID experience, which involved masking small children and letting schools stay out for way too long, which I think has set back a lot of children for a year or more, maybe some permanently. I think the medical establishment needed to be sort of shook up a little bit, maybe disrupted a little bit. Not of course destroyed or anything like that. We have one of the best medical systems in the world, but I think every now and then systems need to be examined in detail and perhaps changed. And so I see RFK as an agent of change. And now, will he be, should he change everything? Of course not.
I want to play a listener voicemail now.
This is Sam from Springfield. Now, if you're in the Senate now, would you vote to repeal the filibuster? And if when you're elected to the Senate, if the filibuster rule is still in existence, would you vote to repeal the rule?
That sounds like Sam Canman, a friend of mine, a strong Democrat, but nevertheless a friend of mine. I believe the filibuster is very important for long-term stable government. I would oppose using the filibuster or using the nuclear option to destroy the filibuster.
End the filibuster, yeah.
To end the filibuster.
I want to ask you about a couple of other issues, one of which is January 6th, 2021. What did you think of what happened that day, and what do you think of all the blanket pardons that happened for the people who stormed the Capitol?
Well, it was a horrible event. It was, in my opinion, it was a riot by a bunch of knuckleheads, I think the president had authorized the National Guard to be out there. They should have had better enforcement. The Capitol Police were not ready for it. Seems like they should have had better security under the circumstances at that time. It was not the president's finest hour, I will say. I think he should have acted sooner at least, I mean, he told, and it's been misreported, but and it's been called an insurrection. It was not an insurrection. It was a bunch of knuckleheads. You know, some people, you know, taking selfies, you know, being inside the Capitol and all that.
And some people spraying bear spray at police officers.
There were some agitators. There were some bad apples in there. The vast majority were not bad apples, and I don't think should have been prosecuted. Some of them should have been. Those who committed violence against Capitol Police should have been prosecuted. I think that was appropriate. But I think the prosecution was overzealous, and I wish they'd gone after the mob. I wish the Biden administration had gone after all the criminals that they let in this country through the open border policy, the way they went after the mostly the law-abiding citizens, you know, people that never had a criminal record, the way they did. But what's misreported often is that President Trump, in his speech, he's been accused of inciting that riot, but he said march to the Capitol and peacefully protest is what he said.
And you've got to fight for your country if you want it.
Well, but he emphasized peaceful protest and fighting. I mean, everybody, Democrat politicians, you know, we all say fight, fight, you know, means fight, you know, ballot wise by protesting. I mean, that's what they're saying about, you know, ICE, you know, get to fight ICE. And I don't think that is inciting, you know, assaults. But some of the other things like Pritzker calling federal law enforcement thugs and Nazis and Gestapo, I do think that is inciting, resisting arrest and maybe even assaulting officers. So January 6th was a terrible day in our country. Not the president's finest hour, certainly not.
Was it wrong for him not to accept the election results? Who do you think won the 2020 election?
Well, Biden was the elected, the duly elected president.
But fairly elected.
Well, yeah? No? he was duly elected by the rules of the time. But I do not agree. It was the most secure election ever. You know, we went from having, basically a handful of mail-in votes, a few thousands, you know, to millions of mail-in votes overnight
because of a
pandemic, without proper safeguards. And the Democrats took advantage of that throughout the country in important areas like Michigan by waiving the only election integrity guideline or guardrail you have for mail-in batting, which is signature verification, by waiving signature verification.
A lot of people who've been in Illinois Republican politics as long as you have, a lot of them don't think it's their party anymore, right? Jim Edgar used to say this, the late Jim Edgar, last time I talked to him before the last election. I've heard similar sentiments from others. Is this still your Republican Party, or is MAGA the future of Republican Party? Are you MAGA? How do you see that? How do you think about that? And I'm sorry to say we only have about 90 seconds left.
As state chairman, I promoted a big tent of Republican Party for all wings of the party, and I still do. We have a lot of differences in our party. I worked for I was on the Edgar, I think, Corporate Acts Advisory Committee when he was Secretary of State. I was a friend of Jim Edgar's. I went to his funeral, and I thought he was a great governor. He became towards the end, I think, a bit liberal. I think he endorsed a Democrat for president, which I never thought that would happen. But he was a good man, and I consider him a friend. And I think he was one of our best governors ever.
And do you think, I mean, you will win the support of the MAGA Republican Party? Your pitch to them?
Well, you know, I people use that term all the time. I'm not sure exactly what it means. I hope to win the support of all Republicans and all independents in this election, because to win this in a state that is currently blue, that I'm trying to turn at least purple by winning one of the 8 statewide seats, I'm going to need votes from not just Republicans, but also independent voters.
You've been listening to Dialogue from Illinois Soul. Today, we shared excerpts of our interviews with the candidates running to replace Dick Durbin in the U.S. Senate. If you want to hear the entire hour-long interview with each candidate, head over to the Dialogue page at ipmnewsroom.org. And don't forget, register now to vote in the primary, which is March 17th, 2026. And finally today, President Biden once promised to lift up American workers by creating good jobs and clean energy. The U.S. committed a lot of money to that. President Trump's distaste for renewables scrambled that plan. But the effort is still alive here in Illinois. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports from Chicago.
Asante McKinney's first job out of school was as a dental assistant. For a while, she thought, this might be my calling.
I enjoyed it. Like I always tell people, good health starts at the mouth.
But in the back of her mind lingered a long-held dream, getting into the skilled trades.
You know, they say that's hard labor, but I like to use my hands. I like thinking. I just didn't know how to go about doing it until I found Hire 360.
Hire 360, that's a nonprofit that recruits people from underserved communities for good-paying jobs in construction. I meet McKinney inside their training center, a converted warehouse. Through a 9-week program, she refreshed her math skills, earned safety certifications, and landed a spot as a trainee with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Already, she's on job sites installing high-voltage wiring.
I'm very hands-on, more than what I thought I would be allowed to be, which is really good for me.
Now, McKinney is hoping, striving for a career as a union electrician, and she has the state's backing. In 2021, Illinois passed the Climate and Equitable Jobs Act, a landmark bill talked about as a model for the country. It set a goal for Illinois to get to 100% clean energy by 2050, with a workforce that includes those deemed equity eligible. That includes people like McKinney, who live in communities that have long faced discrimination and heavy pollution. Pat Devaney of the Illinois AFL-CIO took part in negotiations.
So equity and making sure our workforce was diverse around clean energy was very much a top priority of labor.
If that sounds familiar, it's because the Biden administration would later advance those same goals. The administration allocated billions of dollars in federal grants and clean energy tax credits to encourage contractors to use union labor and seek a diverse talent pool. The hope was those incentives would create millions of middle-class jobs. But President Trump isn't a fan.
It's a green new scam, greatest scam in history, the greatest in history.
So now tax credits for wind and solar projects are getting phased out within a few years, far sooner than planned. And the vision for pulling historically disadvantaged workers into clean energy jobs has gotten murky. In a statement to NPR, White House spokesman Kush Desai wrote, "Instead of DEI boondoggles that accomplish nothing, the Trump administration is laying the groundwork for Americans of all backgrounds to help build our next golden age." Still in Illinois, Pat Devaney says the work is getting results.
I don't see Illinois changing course one bit in how we're approaching renewable investments, climate change, and certainly how we approach DEI and promoting diversity in our workforce.
He says Illinois is still pouring hundreds of millions of dollars of its own into the transition to clean energy. The problem is contractors were anticipating those generous federal tax credits on top of state investments. Devaney fears the early sunsetting of those tax credits will lead contractors to cancel planned projects, costing Illinois tens of thousands of jobs. What's more, they may not plan new projects.
I still don't think people can wrap their mind around the massive amounts of investments that they were going to make and the positive impact that was going to have on our country in terms of job creation.
Now, not everything has come to a screeching halt. In fact, right now, there's a rush to get renewable projects going while the tax credits are still available. Asante McKinney is excited about her new career and what it will mean for her family. She and her wife live on the south side of Chicago with their 2-year-old son.
You know, he's an amazing kid, but I always ask myself, can I see my son walking to school from over here? No.
She's already imagining the day when she can buy a house elsewhere.
That was a big part of why I wanted to get into the trades, is for better living.
And also to be able to point to projects and tell her son, I had something to do with that. Andrea Hsu, NPR News, Chicago.
Dialogue and Illinois Soul are part of Illinois Public Media, a service of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Our theme is composed by Lamont Holden. I'm Reginald Hardwick. We'll talk with you again next week.